Chapter 3. The meadows are wet, and from the pathways and tracks the water runs gurgling. In the pocket of my greatcoat is a small pickle jar, and I walk along the brook by the poplars. As a youngster, I used to catch fish and butterflies here, and here I used to lie down under the trees and dream. In springtime, it would be full of water weeds and frog spawn. Bright green bushes of waterweed flickered to and fro in the little clear waves. Long-legged skaters zigzagged between the stalks of the sedge, and shoals of tittlebacks in the sun cast their swift, slim shadows on the golden spotted sand. But now it is cold and damp. The poplars stand beside the stream in a long line. Their branches are bare, but a soft blue bloom is on them. One day they will be green again and rustling, and the sun will lie warm and blessed over this stretch of ground that holds so many memories of my childhood. And then I shall have forgotten the war, and all will be again as it used to be. I stamp my foot on the sloping edge of the bank. A couple of fish dart out from under it. At sight of them I can contain myself no longer. Where the stream narrows so that I can bestride it with my legs, I wait, watching, and at last scoop up two tittlebacks in my hollowed hand. I drop them into my jar and examine them. They dart to and fro, lovely and perfect with their three spines, their slender brown bodies and quivering pectoral fins. The water is clear as crystal, and spangles of light on the glass are reflected in it. Suddenly, my breath is quite taken away. So piercingly do I see how beautiful it is, this water in the glass, the lights, and the reflections. I hold it carefully in my hand and wander farther. I carry it cautiously and look into it often with beating heart, as if I had caught my childhood in it and now would take it back home with me. I squat on the edge of the pool where dense layers of duckweed are floating and see the blue-marbled salamanders, like little mines, dangling vertically as they come up for air. Caddisfly larvae creep slowly through the mud. A beetle paddles lazily along the bottom, and from under a decaying root, the astonished eyes of a motionless pond frog look up at me. I see everything, and more is there even than can be seen. Memory is there, and hopes, and past happiness. Cautiously, I take up my jar and go on, searching, hoping. The wind blows, and the mountains lie blue along the skyline. Suddenly, a spasm of alarm sweeps over me. Down, man! Down! Under cover! You're in full view here! I crouch down in mad fear. I spread my arms, ready to sprint forward and take shelter behind a tree. I tremble and pant. Now I breathe again. It is over, and I look around foolishly. No one has seen me. It is a moment before I am calm again. Then I make a dive for my pickle jar that has fallen out of my hand. The water is all spilled, but the little fish are still flapping about inside it. I stoop down to the stream and let fresh water pour in. I push on slowly, absorbed in my thoughts. The wood is nearer now. A cat stalks across the pathway. There the railway embankment cuts through the fields and is lost again in the thicket. One could build dugouts there, I think to myself. Good deep ones with concrete roofs. Then extend the line of trench to the left with cover saps and listening posts. And over there a few machine guns. No, two would be enough. The rest in the wood. Then practically the whole terrain would be under crossfire. The poplars would have to come down so as not to give the enemy artillery a point to register on, and behind there, on the hill, a couple of trench mortars. Then let them come. A train whistles, and I look up. What's this I am doing? I came here to recover the scene of my childhood, and I am drawing a system of trenches across it. It has become a habit. I say to myself, we see no countryside now, only terrain. Terrain for attack and defense. The old mill on the top there is no mill, but a strong point. The wood is no wood. It is artillery cover. Such things will always creep in. I shake the thought off and try to remember past times, but I do not succeed very well, and I no longer feel so happy as I did. I have no wish to go farther. I turn back. In the distance, I see a solitary figure approaching. It is Georg Rahe. What are you doing here? He asks in surprise. What are you? Nothing, he says. Same here, I reply. And the pickle jar? He asks and looks at me a trifle mockingly. I turn red. Nothing to be ashamed of, he says. Been trying to catch fish again. I nod. And then what? He asks. I shake my head. Yes, hardly goes with a uniform, eh? He says meditatively. We sit down on a log and begin to smoke. Rahe takes off his cap. Remember how we used to exchange postage stamps here? Yes, I remember. And how the timber yard smelt in the sun of resin and tar. How the poplar trees shimmered and the wind blew up cool from the water. I still remember it all. How we hunted for green frogs. How we used to read books here together. How we would talk of the future and of life. Where it lay waiting for us there beyond the blue horizon, alluring as soft music. It all turned out rather differently, eh, Ernst? Says Rahe, and smiles. This smile that we all have, something bitter and something weary. Why, we even caught fish differently out there. One bomb into the water, and then up they would come, floating to the surface, with burst swimming bladders and white bellies. It was more practical, there's no denying. How is it, do you suppose, Georg? I ask. That we just sit around here like this and don't know even what we should begin to do. You find there's something missing, Ernst, eh? I nod. He taps me on the chest. I think I can tell you. I've been thinking about it, too. You see, this here, he points to the meadows before us. That was life. It flowered and grew, and we grew along with it. And that, behind us, he motions with his head backwards into the distance. That was death. It killed and destroyed something of us along with the rest. He smiles again. We're in need of repairs a little, my boy. Perhaps things would be better if only it were summer, I say. Everything is easier in summer. No, it's not there the trouble lies, he answers, blowing the smoke before him. It's something very different from that, I think. What then? I ask. He shrugs his shoulders and stands up. Let's be going, Ernst. Would you care to know what I've decided to do? He stoops down to me. I think I'm going to become a soldier again. You're crazy, Georg, I say in consternation. Not at all, he retorts, and for an instant is deadly earnest. Perhaps merely logical. I stop. But, good God, Georg, he walks on. Well, you see, I've been here now a couple of weeks longer than you, he says, and starts talking of other things. When the first houses appear, I take my jar with the tittlebacks and empty it back into the brook. With flicks of their tails, they are gone. The jar I leave standing on the bank. I take leave of Georg, and he walks off slowly down the street. In front of our house, I stand still and look after him. His words have strangely troubled me. A vague, threatening something seems to be sneaking upon me. It retreats when I try to grapple with it. It disperses when I advance upon it. And then it gathers again behind me and watches. The sky hangs like lead over the low shrubbery of the Luisenplatz. The trees are bare. A loose window is clashing in the wind. And amid the frowsy alder bushes in the garden of the square squats the November twilight, dank and cheerless. I peer over into it, and suddenly it is as if I saw it all today for the first time, so unfamiliar that I hardly know it again. This dirty, damp patch of grass, was this really the setting of those years of my childhood, so radiant and winged in my memory? This waste, dreary square with the factory yonder. Can this be that quiet corner of earth we called home, and which, alone amid the waters of destruction out there, meant hope to us and salvation from perishing in the flood? Or was it not rather a vision of some far other place than this gray street with its hideous houses that rose up there over the shell holes, like some wild, sad dream in the grudging intervals between death and death? In my memory, was it not far more shining and lovely, more spacious and abounding with 10,000 things? Is that no longer true, then? Did my blood lie and my memory deceive me? I shiver. It is different, yet without having changed. The clock in the tower of Neubauer's factory is still going. It strikes the hours still as in the days when we used to stare up at its face to see the finger move. The black boy with the clay pipe is still sitting over the tobacconist's shop where Georg Raha brought us our first cigarettes. And in the grocer's opposite are the same pictures advertising the same soap powder. Otto Vogt and I scorched its eyes out with a burning glass one sunny time. I peer in through the window. The seared spots are still visible, even now. But the war lies between, and Otto Vogt was killed at Kemmel long ago. I do not understand how it can be that I should stand here and yet no longer feel about it as I did in the barracks and out there in the shell holes. What has become of all its riches, the thrill, the brightness, the glamour, and that other thing that is unnameable? Had my memory of it more of life than the reality itself, or has that become reality, while this has shrunk and shriveled up, till now nothing is left of it but bare scaffolding where gay banners once waved? Did the splendor detach itself from these things and places, now only to float over them like a forlorn cloud? Did the years out there burn the bridges that lead back into the past? Questions, questions, but no answer.